啊，这边请上去。There are some people here this morning. I think this hour of the day people would be awake. I felt real compassion for Michelle. Anybody has to get up and talk at that ungodly hour of the day, dear Lord in heaven. I tell you what, you know, in our program it says that we're entirely ready to go to any length to get here. And I want to tell you about getting to go to any length to get here. Yesterday morning when I woke, it was flooding in Little Rock. And it was also flooding in Rose City, which is a suburb of North Little Rock, and I want to straighten that out. I don't know why I have to do this every damn time. Little Rock and North Little Rock are two separate towns. I'm not on the north side of Little Rock. North Little Rock is an entity unto itself, and we are rivals with Little Rock, so it's really important that you know I'm from North Little Rock. So somebody keeps saying, you from Little Rock? No. Anyway, yesterday morning I got up and we was having a toad strangler. And I looked out and I went tearing out on my porch to get my paper. And I thought, well, you know, it's really raining. I mean, it's just coming down in buckets. And it had started raining somewhere during the night. And we've had a lot of rain, probably like y'all have lately. We've had a lot of rain. And I live not too far from the Arkansas River, so the water table's real high. And it don't take a lot of rain where I live. And so then later after I went in and took a shower and got ready, I went out and I looked and I said, well, hell, it's ankle deep out here in my front yard. And by the time I got ready to leave for the airport, it was calf deep now. And I'm saying, well, now, this presents a problem because I'm going to obviously have to wade to the car. And the way they make blue jeans, they're so tight-legged now that there's no way to roll them up. Come on, play with me now. Come on. Was that as good for you as it was for me, Leon? Don't you love a bunch of incompetent alcoholics at work? Hello, hello, hello. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Can you hear anybody?
Well, I can talk without a microphone. Okay. So anyway, I said, well, here I am, these tight-legged jeans. So I said, well, it's obvious I'm going to have to take these off. So I took off my jeans and my shoes and my socks, and I put on some shorts, and I took them out to the car with a towel. Then I go back in, I get the case in my purse and carry it out and come back and get the suitcase, lock it up, and walk out the door. And now I'm standing out there, and I said, what the hell? I took off my shorts in the middle of my front yard. The neighbors have seen worse. And thing about it is, I figured that probably the only person that would notice that would be John Henry, who lives next door to me, and he's in his 80s, and it might be just the thing he needs to get him through the day. So I took off my shorts, and I threw them in the back seat, and then I got in the car and dried off, and the only tricky part is trying to put on blue jeans sitting in the car. Now, maybe when I was younger, this was easier to do. Somehow or another, I couldn't figure, but anyway, I finally got over there, got dressed on the way as I'm driving to the airport. Got there and got on the plane, and they said, did you have any trouble on your flight? That was the easiest part. That was the easiest part, was on the plane, because I was already dressed by that time. And then I get off here, and I got to go see the premier tourist attraction of Atlanta, the Varsity. And the girls, Raynell and Pam, picked me up at the airport, and we went tearing off to the Varsity and had one of them chili burgers, and that was good stuff, good stuff. Soul food of the South. Good hamburger. And it was side order grits or greens. I mean, you just can't beat it, can you? But anyway, got here, and I do want to thank the committee for having invited me. I have a wonderful room. I just can't get over sometimes the difference in accommodations, can you, Jim? Last week I was in San Antonio, and I was in a room that was smaller than my dining room at home. And that included the bathroom, and the commode was touching the wall on one side. Now, that's interesting. Makes you wonder how you're going to get on that thing, you know. And I was just real excited when I got to my room, and I said, oh, God, it's in the middle of the floor. I won't have to figure out how to sit on it. I do have lovely accommodations and a fruit bowl. Now, I got to tell you, when I got to my room, I know that I'm a big girl, they had two fruit bowls in my room, and one of them said, Mere Pearl Tea, room 419, and the other one said, Johnny Harris, room 419. And I said, Debbie and J.D. are going to love this. Johnny and I have been together lots of times, but not quite so together as I think they had us planned for. And I said, get on the phone, girls. We got to do something real quick here because we don't want to upset Johnny. Well, and he evidently got so upset he didn't even join us last night. I'm sorry. Anyway, it's nice to be here, and I do appreciate the invitation. It's always nice to be asked to go and speak to a group of Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous. Because your theme, Celebrate the Miracle, it's a miracle that I'm here. It's a miracle. We're all miracles. We are the lucky ones. We're the ones that are here. And we're the ones that have a chance in life now. And that is a miracle. I want to share with you, in general, what I used to be like, what happened, and what my life is like today. And my life is the best it's ever been. And, you know, a lot of times you come into these rooms and you hear, come in and you work the steps and everything gets wonderful. Well, I don't know that that's true. I think that you come in and you work the steps and you learn how to live your life to the best that you can. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to be troubles and problems and all those kind of things. But for the first time in your life, you're going to have some handle on how to deal with it. And that's what the program gives me. And I don't have to do it alone anymore. Now, that's been real important to me the last few years. Very, very. I get tickled about people I talk about. They've been in a long time. They don't have to go to as many meetings. Well, I'm just the opposite. I go to more meetings than I've ever gone to in my life, and I need my meetings more now than I ever did in the beginning because I'm there and I know what I'm there for now. And before, you know, you'd go to meetings, and you see a lot of people come in, they sit in the meetings, you know. They come in, they take a chair, and they sit in the meetings, and all of a sudden they become. And they think that just sitting in the meeting, they're going to become an Al-Anon or an AA member, and that's no more than sitting in the garage makes you a car. You have to do something. There's something that has to happen inside. You're going to have to do something. And I hate it, too. A lot of times our old-timers, you don't see them as much in the meetings anymore. Well, I'm the old-timer of my group, and I want to be there. Because if you don't, you know, the Lewins will screw it up for you if you don't watch them. You know, you got to watch them. You know how they are. You know, they'll try to change something on you. But the meetings are very important to me and the fellowship. And it's all together. It's a package. I don't think that I could make it off of any one ingredient, but it takes all of those things together in order for me to be here today and to be in my right mind as much as possible at this hour of the morning. But I am dressed. I mean, you are looked out there, let's face it. Now, I started off, I was the youngest of four children. And my father spoiled me rotten. You see, I was a change of life baby, and so I was raised as an only child. And my father and I developed a real strong bonding there because my mother was an achiever. She was an overachiever. She was a workaholic. And my mother seemed to feel that if you weren't working, you weren't worth anything. So she constantly had to be doing in order to feel like she was worthwhile. And if you weren't doing, you weren't worthwhile either. Well, Daddy and I weren't worthwhile. And, because you see, Daddy retired before I was born. And so Daddy retired to do two things, and that was to fish and hunt. And so I became his partner. And I would go with him, and I loved to go with my Daddy fishing and hunting. And we had a lot of good times together and a lot of good memories. And Daddy would teach me about life and things as we were out there sitting on the boat or walking through the woods, and I love those times. And somehow or another, because Daddy spoiled me rotten and let me have anything the way I wanted it, I thought that was what love was. And you know, what you believe is true to you, whether it's the truth or not. And so that was what I was going to believe. And because my mother did not spoil me rotten, my mother didn't love me. I knew my mother didn't love me. You see, my mother, to me, was put on this earth to make my life miserable. She had rules and regulations that you just wouldn't believe. You know, like you had to go to bed at a certain time, you had to eat certain stuff. I mean, it was just terrible. Because I've always liked doing things my way, the way I want to do it, when I want to do it, how I want to do it. Not that I'm self-centered or anything. That's just the way I always wanted to do it. And Daddy was very content. I think probably at his age, that it was just easier to give in than the hassle that would happen. Because trust me, there would be a hassle when I didn't get my way. I started off real young. We're having those screaming coma fits, you know. I mean, you know, the kind where you just, you know, fling yourself about and scream and holler until somebody gives in. Well, it wasn't going to be Mama. I could have been bald-headed before I'd get my hair pulled out for Mama. But Daddy couldn't stand that, you know. So I learned real early. Well, I like to say, I learned a lot of things, but one of the things that I did learn was when I went to school, on the very first day of school, I began to make observations. And I looked around, and no one there who had parents that was with them had parents the age of mine. And I looked at my parents, and I wondered what was wrong with them. You see, up to this point in time, I had enjoyed being the status of the change of life baby because all my mother and daddy's friends were old people, and there wasn't any kids, so I got all the attention. And I loved attention. And see, now I was, and I was in school, and I had to share attention. I didn't work too well in school with other kids. I didn't know how to deal. Like the little girl was talking this morning, I didn't know how to relate to my own peer group. It took me a long time. So what I did was I had one friend at a time, and I took hostages. Now, I didn't know I did that, but you know, when I did a four-step inventory and I began to look at my life, I began to see some very little nasty patterns that began to poke their head up, and I had a girlfriend, my best girlfriend. It was my only girlfriend for a long time. And whenever, because she was my only girlfriend, I didn't want her to have any other girlfriends. Because I wanted her to be my everything as I'd be her everything. And when other kids would come up and act like they'd be friendly with her, I couldn't wait to get them off and tell them something about her so they'd leave her alone. So I could have Shirley all to myself. And I realized how selfish that was, but you see, that also is because of the fear. I didn't feel comfortable with making a lot of those relationships. Well, I went on like I was an overachiever. In our house, straight A's were required. You got no pat on the back for a straight A. If you brought home an A-minus, then you called hell. So I learned early on, in order to keep her off my back, you just make the grade. But you know, I couldn't keep Mama off my back because I couldn't mind my Mama. I could not. My daddy died when I was 12, and this my whole life was to change. Not only just from the social aspect, but the fact that our economics changed, the friends that I had, everything was going to change when my daddy died. And it was very difficult for a kid of 12. And I had a lot of feelings about that, and I had a lot of anger about that, but I didn't know how to express it. And my mother was in a lot of grief of her own, and so she didn't notice what was happening to me. I think I probably needed professional help at that time in order to deal with that, but I didn't have it. And instead, I began to hate. And I began to look at my mother, and I began to look at the fact that Daddy died, and I thought, you know, God doesn't love me. Now, I'd gone to church all my life, and they'd say, Jesus loves you and all this good stuff. But if that be the case, how come my daddy died? The only person in the world who loved me. And I said, God doesn't care anything about me. And I began to look at Mama, and I began to compare her to the way that Daddy did things. And so she always came up on the short end of the stick, always. Well, now, I know you might find this hard to believe, but now, as a child, I had a weight problem. And I also had a revenge problem, too. But I was a social misfit in my school. I used to think that I was an individualist, and I know that's not true. I was a social misfit, and I used to think a lot of things. I used to think, God, I'm so witty. I have this really quick mind. Sarcastic was what it was, you know. And I felt things a lot deeper than a lot of people. You know, I just knew things a lot deeper. I know today that was, you know, sensitive bitch. You know, there's a lot of things that I learned about myself that I didn't know then, but that's how I was. So I'm going along, and I'm the overachiever, and I'm doing all these things. I have two records. I was the valedictorian, the honor graduate, and all like this, and had all this wonderful praise on one side. I also had more days in detention hall than any member of the National Honor Society ever. But that's the way my life was. You see, I could make the grades and do the studies, but and the social conduct was not very good. Well, they put a base, an Air Force base, in Little Rock in 1957. And they said there were 10 men to every woman. And by God, I wanted my 10. So I went out trolling at the base. And there's no limit to sick men in this world, I'll tell you that. And I met several of them out there, and I had a lot of fun during that period of time, and all of a sudden, then this guy asked me if he was going to take me away from all this. Actually, what he said was, I want you. I need you. I love you. Now, there's significance to the order in which that came, you know. There was a lust attack followed by a sick dependent that was just going to be called love at the end. But anyway, I knew it wasn't going to work. See, he was a Yankee. And he didn't like cornbread, turnip greens, and grits, you know. He just didn't know how to eat. And he didn't know how to do a lot of things that we did. But he told me he'd take me away from home. Now, you see, when Daddy died, Mama and I declared war on one another. And it was hell in our home every day. Every day it was hell in our home. And I was verbally abusive to my mother. She was verbally and physically abusive to me. I would have hit her back, but I was afraid if I did, she'd kill me, and she probably would have. I know that today from my own personality. Because I know today that when I was physically abusive, if people had tried to fight back, I would have really hurt you bad. So this was the kind of relationship that my mother and I had. So I wanted to get away from home more than anything. I knew that it was going to be better over there. I didn't know that wherever you go, you take you with you. It never occurred to me. But I just knew things, and I was going to be better over there. And so we went over there, and I didn't want to go as far over there as we went. See, we went to Newfoundland. Now, Newfoundland in those days, and probably still, is the last outpost of humanity. They were about 100 years behind what we were here in the United States. I just couldn't believe that people were living like that. I couldn't believe that I was living like that. And you see, my drug of choice, if I have one, is adrenaline. And I love excitement. When things start getting boring, I get dangerous. Because I create excitement to feed that sickness within me that has to have that excitement. And it doesn't make any difference if it's negative or positive. It doesn't make any difference. Adrenaline is adrenaline. Now, I'm going to tell you now, you can have too much adrenaline. I didn't think it was possible. But last year when I was out in California for the quake... I'm here to tell you, I was there and things are moving and the things are rocking and rolling and you're looking out and stuff is just waving in the breeze and you're going, oh shit. Now, living in the South, you know what to do when a tornado comes. You know what to do. But what do you do for an earthquake? Who knew? Now, there's smart aleck out there said, well, it was in the front of the phone book. Funny, when an earthquake comes, that's the last thing you think about is a phone book. At least in my mind. So I'm just sort of running in circles, you know. What do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And so finally I decided just to wait it out. And I knew I was going to die. There's no question in my mind. I knew I was going to die. Because I never felt... Now, let me tell you. There's a whole new meaning of the word powerlessness. I'm true to tell you now. There's a whole thing about that. And when it was all over, and it took 26 seconds. Now, that's not a long time. But when it's happening, that's a long time. And when it was all over, like I said, I was just sitting there, my fingers tingled, my toes tingled, and everything in between, and I said, oh, God, it's happened, it's happened. I have overdosed with adrenaline. So you can get too much of a good thing. But anyway, like I say, I would do these things that would create excitement in my life. And while I was in this land, I created enough excitement, because, see, I love to go to the club. I love the bars, I love the little music, I love the sound of the tinkling glasses, and I love to be with people who were drinking, because these were fun people. You never knew what they were going to do. See? So there's a certain amount of excitement. You're living on the edge, you know, and I like that, and I liked being there, and like I say, there weren't that many dependents at that time up there, so there were a lot of guys. And I'd forget things. See, I've had a problem with memory all my life. See, I'd forget like I was married. And I'd create some excitement for myself. And I created enough to where it darn near cost me my marriage right there. So anyway, I decided maybe I needed to do something constructive, so I went to work for the Red Cross. They take anything, you know. I was assistant field director for the Red Cross. Now, if you're in the military, you know that is a good power position. Because not an emergency leave goes off an overseas base without Red Cross verification. So it gave you a little power and a little manipulation ability and things like that. And I learned that one of the best bartering things that we had was alcohol. Because in those days, where there's no tax on the liquor when you were on the foreign base, you could buy a gallon of Seagram's for $5. You could buy a gallon. Isn't that sickening? You could buy a case of Chevy's, a case, for around $30. So it was wonderful. See, you could trade. And the people back in the States didn't have that, so what we would do, we would send it back on the KC-97s back to Westover, and we would deal with the people back there. So when it came time for assignments back to the States, and I had been there 5 years, they said, y'all are going to Minot, North Dakota. I'm not. Not this kid. I've been in ice and snow for 5 years. I'm going back to Little Rock Air Force Base. Because, see, it's all better back over there. Now, that was a place I couldn't wait to get away from. Now I got to go back again, you see. It's all different now, don't you know? Don't you know? And so they said, but there's not an opening there. And I said, make one. So the guy in the SAC assignment session says it will cost a case of Chevys. I said, own the next plane down. So, all of a sudden, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, arrived at Little Rock Air Force Base as a missile inspector, and he had never seen one. Doesn't that make you feel secure? Things went downhill back in Little Rock. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? It didn't take us but about, 6 weeks, 3 months to realize that it was still not working for us. And so I told him, I said, I have a deal for you. I want to be separated. And he said, separated? And I said, yes. He said, what does that mean? I said, it means that I live here and you don't live here, but you pay for me to live here. I was not willing to be self-supporting on my own contributions. And he thought I was going through a phase, so he agreed to that. Well, 4 years later, I still am in my phase, you know. Anyway, he transferred out, and he went on, and I stayed there in Little Rock. And now, for the first time in my life, I'm free. In my mind, I'm saying, I'm free. I'm not living with Mama, and I'm not living with Wes. I am free. I can do anything and everything I want to. That ought to scare the world. So I went out, and I did all those things that I knew I was free to do. And you know something? It didn't feel good. Things never were the way that I thought they were going to be. And guess what? In a short period of time, I got bored. Well, I began to watch then the neighbors. You know, it's amazing. There's a lady who lives on our street. We call her the blind slapper. Because anytime a car goes by, the blind slap, you know, that's her whole life, watching other people go back and forth. You know, I'm sure you've got neighbors like that. You know, they don't have any excitement. They thrive off of your excitement. Well, you know, that's why I start, and I notice now. There was one of them across the street. Now, one of them was an alcoholic. Now, the reason I say it was one of them, and I knew exactly what an alcoholic was. You see, my mother's father died of alcoholism. My mother's mother died of alcoholism. My mother's brother was shot in bed drunk with another man's wife. He was my favorite. I could relate to Uncle A.B. But all of her family had alcoholism. And when they drank, they got mean. They came home and they would fight with one another. So to me, this was what alcoholics were. Well, this boy across the street, he fit that picture. He'd go out, he'd get drunk, he'd beat his wife up. He was one of them. Well, she was pregnant, and I felt sorry for that little old girl. And she came over to my house, and she said that she had gone into labor that night when he came in and beat her up. And she said, would you take me to the hospital? And I said, I'd be glad to. I'll be glad to. And when we went back over to her house, you know how a drunk will pass out with that little smirk on their face? That's the way he's laying there on that bed, you know, all sprawled out with that little smirk. And I thought, you know, somebody ought to whip you. And that's when I had my first spiritual awakening. I'm somebody. So I tied him up in a bed sheet. I took a slat out of his bed, and I beat the fool out of him. And I loved it. It made you feel good all over. And little did I know that was going to be the preview of coming attraction. Now, on the other side of me, there was a gentleman who the doctor had told him he was an alcoholic, and if he didn't quit drinking, he would die. So he quit drinking, and that's as far as he ever went. And I'll tell you what, I think if that's the case, you're better off dead. Because that untreated alcoholism, he was the most miserable person to be around in the whole world. And I was living my lifestyle, you know. And my lifestyle was that I went to bed in the morning. Because I was out at night, and I was doing things, and I was having fun. And he had a garden and a tiller, and he'd get out there in that darn garden at 8 o'clock in the morning and want to run that noisy little old tiller. Well, that's disturbing to someone who's got delicate sleeping habits. And so I would go out, and I explained to him that he shouldn't do that. And he told me, shut my mouth and get my fat ass back in the house. He shouldn't have done that. I went down to my mama's and rooted through the garage and found my daddy's frog-gigging headlight, and I mowed my grass at 11:30 at night. Well, the sheriff came to see me. And if you know, have you ever noticed how law enforcement individuals, by and large, are narrow-minded? He didn't understand what I was trying to do, so I went to Plan B. Now, Freeman had six little beagle dogs. Now, those are the barkingest little dogs. I mean, you got six of them. I mean, that's a lot of noise. And I'd wait till the wee hours of the morning, and I'd run up and down his dog yard fence with a broom handle. And then I'd run, jump back on my porch, and he'd come out and scream at him in his drawer legs, hose him down. He'd stomp around, cuss, go back in the house, and I'd wait a little while, and we'd do it one more time. And the sheriff came to see me. Well, the sheriff and I, we had several more little incidents, and the sheriff and I are developing a relationship. And I decided maybe I need to look in another area, and that's when I noticed the softball team. There was a softball team in the neighborhood. It was a neighborhood team. And there were men and women both on that team, all ages. And I said, that's where I need to be. So I lost me some weight, got me some hot pants and some stretch boots, and I went out and I joined the softball team. It was wonderful, wonderful. After the game, we'd go to somebody's house, and we'd talk about our strategy for the next game, and we'd pop a few tops. Some of them would smoke a few joints. Just normal neighborhood. And we're just doing our thing, you know. And then all of a sudden, one night, it was my turn to have everybody at my house, and this young man, he was 18, which was not legal age to drink, got drunk at my house at the after-the-game party. And Roger had bought a China tea set for his mother for Mother's Day. And he was talking about going home, and I thought, God Almighty, he is going to get drunk. He's drunk, and he's going to get picked up going home. And if he does, I know who'll pick him up, because I know who runs this beat real well, was the sheriff. And he'll tell him where he got booze, and I can't have that. I can't have that. So what I'll do is I'll drive him home. I'll take him home. So I'm taking the little boy home, and he goes. And so when we got there, he pulled out this China tea set, and he was about to drop it. So, you know, being the helpful Al-Anon that I am, free Al-Anon, I pick up the China tea set, and I said, come on, I'll help you. And so we go through the house, and he's flipping on lights, and like I say, we're going into a house I've never been into before in my life. I'm with a drunken 18-year-old kid that I just know from the team. And when he flips the light on in his bedroom, there's a man laying on the bed with nothing but his jockey shorts on. And he looks up and says, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. And I said, not tonight, fella. Oh, that's who I'm married to. I didn't meet mine singing on the front row of the choir. Well, you know, we didn't get together right from then, but several months later we met again and we started dating, and we had a wonderful, honest, open relationship. We had such a wonderful, we had fun together. God, he was exciting. He was good looking. We would sit and he would tell how terrible his ex-wife had been to him. I would tell him how terrible Wes had been to me. And we just went on like that. We had this wonderful relationship. What we had in common was our sickness. And we didn't realize that, you know. But sicky is a trash. You know, crows don't fly with doves. That's the reason we started to go to our own level. But anyway, we had been going together a couple of years, and J.D. said, why don't we just get married? And that's when my memory came back. And I said, oh, I can't. And he said, why not? And I said, I'm already married. He said, married? And he said, you sure don't act married. I said, well, I didn't feel married. You know, I just sort of, and he said, how do you just forget being married? I said, I don't know. It just happens, you know. And he, you know, he should have known then there was something wrong with me. You know what I mean? And I said, but don't worry about it. I said, I'll think about it, and maybe I'll get a divorce. And I said, how did you think that I could not work, live here in the manner in which I live? And he said, I thought you was rich. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So I left my wonderful job of sitting at home, doing nothing and being paid, and I married an alcoholic so I could go to work. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Well, I got my divorce, and then J.D. and I got divorced on Monday and married on Friday. I don't believe in long engagements. And Now the father of them came to my house. Now, his drinking, I knew that he didn't know how to drink right. But it wasn't a big problem, you see. But once you got married, it all of a sudden became, he was your responsibility. And what were people going to think? And all of a sudden, I became the keeper of the person. And I didn't know that happened like that. I had no idea. It's real funny. If you had asked me the day before we got married to tell you about J.D., I would have told you every glowing quality he has, which there were many. After we got married, it's like I noticed all those negatives now, and I'm going to change the man. I'm going to change him. And drinking was one of those things. He didn't know how to hold his liquor. Now, I drank. Social drinking was a way of life for me. And I enjoyed the alcohol. I enjoyed the atmosphere and the people and all like that. But it didn't do for me what it did for him. I could feel the same whether I was drinking or not drinking. It didn't matter to me. But I noticed a distinct change in the way he acted and the way he seemed to feel after he drank. Well, we began to have little fights and arguments because I would get on him about his drinking, so we'd go through periods of non-drinking, and then there would be periods when you would wish they were drunk because at least they're easier to manage when they're drunk. You know, that's the reason a lot of us have problems when we come into the fellowship and our alcoholic sobers up. We can't manipulate them like we once could. All of a sudden, they remember stuff. You know, I would tell him things that he didn't do. When I found out he couldn't remember what happened, I made it good. I tried shock therapy on him, you know. Guess what you did? And like what he did wasn't bad enough. I can remember the insanity. You know, we were driving down the road. J.D., my sister, decided one year for Christmas that she'd get J.D. something he really liked. She got him a wine-making kit. That's all you need is help from the family. What better gift for an alcoholic than his own wine-making kit? I read the instructions. He never reads instructions on anything. And I knew it wasn't going to work because one of the first things it said was after the wine was made, you had to let it age for a minimum of a year. Intuitively, I knew that wasn't going to work. And, you know, one night I had been invited to a baby shower, and all the men had been invited to a get-together over to the prospective father's home while the shower was held next door. And so while I was getting ready, J.D. was sitting in the living room drinking grape Kool-Aid. That's what he said it was, grape Kool-Aid. And so when we got ready to go, he said, why don't you drive? I'm tired. You know, I mean, he knew about the drinking and driving. He'd had so many DWIs. And he said, why don't you drive? And I said, okay, and I'm driving. Now, let's say I had a man who was totally sober a few minutes before. I just took a bath. Now, he drank an iced tea glass full of grape Kool-Aid. And about two-thirds of the way there, all of a sudden, he just sort of went down in the floorboard. I said, what the hell's the matter with you? He said, I don't know. What's the matter with you? And he said, I don't know. I said, you're drunk. He said, that's right. And I said, how did you do that? You know, it's amazing. How did they do that? And he said, it was a great Kool-Aid. And I said, great Kool-Aid wouldn't get you drunk, you quit. He says, it does if it comes out of those little green bottles. I said, you drink. I said, that wine could kill you. It said, wait for a year. I'm not waiting on nothing for a year. And I said, well, now, look, I don't have time to take you home and get back, so you're going to have to straighten up and act right. Now, can you realize the insanity of that? You're telling a man who's in a wad in the floorboard, straighten up and act right. And you know something? I expected him to do that. I said, whatever you do, but God, don't you embarrass me. He said, oh, yeah. We got there. He opened the car door. He took about two steps and did a triple flip into a cactus garden. Got him out of the cactus garden. Now they're going to spend the next hour or two picking needles out of J.D. I go to the shower. I'm so humiliated. I can't believe this is happening. We get back and all the guys are mad. They're mad. See, they had this poker game planned. And J.D.'s sitting there playing poker with three of his cards facing the wrong way. None of them are drinking. It ain't funny. And so one of them says, what we need to do is get him something to eat. You know, isn't it funny how the non-alcoholic thinks that food is the solution? So they take him with him. They got to looking at me and decided he wouldn't be too safe there. So they took him with them, and they were gone to McDonald's. Now, McDonald's was probably 5 or 6 blocks away. They were gone for 2.5 hours. You see, they made a mistake. They went into McDonald's and left him in the car. He escaped. He got into a car with a bunch of teenagers, and they went all over town. They didn't know him. He'd never seen them, but they were having fun. The kids finally got tired of him and brought him back to McDonald's, where the other guys were going crazy, and they couldn't come back without him because they knew I would not accept that. We get to the table. The food, needless to say, is very cold. And JD's sitting there, and he's saying, "This doesn't even taste good." He says, "It's just nothing in it." I said, "That's right. It's laying in the floor. All you have is a bun." Now, when I related that story to him the next morning in graphic detail, his solution was, "We'll move. We'll never go there anymore." I said, "I don't think you'll have to worry about that." These were just fun things. Just fun things happening in our life. You know, it never occurred to us that he was sick. It never happened. There were many, many instances like this. And the bottom line was always the same. I was trying to keep him from getting drunk, and he was getting drunk. Well, after a while, let's say, things began to get a little serious at our house. And J.D., I would no longer allow him to drink in the home. I wouldn't let that happen anymore. So he would drink outside the home, and so here we're going to have more DWIs now because he's forced to leave the home to drink. And not only that, I would go looking for him. There was a period, you know, you go through different phases. You go through the phase of staying at home. You go through the phase of looking for him. You just go through different phases. And at this particular one, when I would go out and I would find him, he would usually have a companion. I would not be thrilled about the companion. And so what I would do is I would run into the nightclub or the bar or the really seedy places that he would go to try to hide. You know, I'd go into any type of place to save my home. And I'd go busting in there, you know, like King Kong, and I'd go over there and I'd turn the table upside down. I'd slap her flat. I'd throw a drink in his face, and I'd proceed to beat the shit out of him. And the bouncer'd throw me out. Cold sober. And every once in a while, I'd get frisky with the bouncer, and then I'd go to jail for assault. So, that was not a happy time in our house. There were many times. Like I say, we played hide and seek. He'd hide it, and I'd seek it. He'd hide, and I'd seek him. I remember one night I was making pickled okra. Good old southern thing, you know. And I ran out of vinegar, and I said, "Honey, would you run up 7-Eleven? It's 3 blocks away. Would you run up 7-Eleven and get me a quart of vinegar?" And he said, "Okay." He brought it back 2 days later. Is there something wrong with this picture, you know? I couldn't understand why these things are happening. But the bottom line would be when he would come home drunk now and he'd open the door, we would get into the fight. And the bottom line was I would have to put him out of my misery. So I would beat him up and shut him up, and then I could drag him off to bed. And then I'd wake him up and tell him about all the things that he did that made me do that to him. And I didn't realize what a game we were playing. And see, I'd become his mother. And I told my little boy, "Don't drink." And my little boy went out and drank. So when my little boy got home, he got whipped. It was just that simple. And he knew it was that simple, too, because once he took his whipping, it was all okay. And he could go back. And we did that one day at a time. One day at a time. Well, all good things come to an end. And so I finally issued the famous ultimatum, in which I really meant this time, "You're leaving." And he had heard that millions of times, and I didn't mean it. But, you know, there's a difference when you mean it, and they can tell you mean it. And he said, "I don't mean to do what I do." He said, "I must be sick." And I said, "Boy, that's the truth. You are sick, sick, sick." And so I took him to my family doctor, like a little child by the hand, drug him in. And I said, "Tell him." And he said, "I think I may have a slight drinking problem." And the doctor said, "Why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know a thing better to do for a drinking problem." And J.D. looked at him, and he was stunned. And he said, "I'm not an alcoholic." And I looked at the doctor and I said, "That's right, he's not." He wasn't like my mom and daddy's people. I mean, he wasn't like mama's people. Therefore, he was not an alcoholic. You see, he was not doing the things that they did. I didn't see it as the same thing. So, the doctor said, "I don't know what to do for you." And J.D. said, "Well, I want a pill." He said, now, I've got some friends that are taking a pill called Anabuse. And he said, and if I take that pill, that's all I need, just a little help to get me over those rough spots. And so what I heard the doctor say was, Anabuse was a pill that if they took it, they couldn't drink. Now, that's not what he said. But, you know, I'm to the point I hear what I want to hear. I say what I want to say. It doesn't make any difference what's said or done. And so I said, okie doke. So we left there with a prescription for Anabuse. And I went to the drugstore and I got it filled out because, you see, I was the dispenser of the pill. I didn't trust him to take the pill. I didn't trust him on anything. He lied too much. By this time, I have high blood pressure, an epileptic dog, and J.D.'s on the pill. Well, every morning going to work in a hurry, I can't guarantee who got what, but everybody got a pill at our house. Now, for years, what have you said? If he'll quit drinking, I'll be okay. Well, guess what? He's not drinking. I'm not okay. Now, there's something real tricky about that. That begins to grate on you. Because now he's suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I'm suffering from untreated Al-Anonism, and we're at war. Now, if I thought war with mother was something, this was nothing. I mean to tell you, we were going at it. We had a cuss fight with each other. Every time we were just like two cats thrown over a clothesline. We were just fighting. And boy, I mean, that was the way it was. From the time we got up in the morning, we were at each other's throats till the time we went to bed. And if you didn't fight in bed, it's just because you're too damn tired. That's the only reason, you know. We just fussing and fighting. Didn't make any difference. The major things. What do you want for supper? Anything. Fried chicken? No, don't want fried chicken. I thought you said anything. Well, anything but fried chicken. Well, how about spaghetti? I hate spaghetti. What do you want? Anything! So I'd fix anything. He'd look at it and say, you don't think me eat that, do you? I'd say, you have a choice. You can eat it or wear it. Sometimes he chose to eat it, sometimes he chose to wear it. Just happy little home. Just having fun. And so finally I got to thinking. And see, that's when you're in trouble, when you get to thinking. And I thought, you know, he's the problem. It wasn't the drinking. It's him. Now, why don't you get a divorce? Oh, see, now this is where you call a committee together, you know, and you do this little conversation. Well, why don't you divorce him? Well, I can't divorce him. Why can't you divorce him? Well, because I've already had one husband, and it was a bad one, and if I've got this one, that means, something's wrong with your picker. Your picker's broken. Well, you don't want that. No, what if you were a widow? Widow, that sounds good. But he's not dying. Details. We'll just put him out of our misery one more time. Sounds good to me. What do you want to do? Oh, I want to take an ice pick and stab him in the neck.
Oh, I sort of like where you take the tires and you run over him and leave the little tire treads. That's good, too. And so I began to have dreams about doing things like this. They were wonderful. These were not nightmares. These were good dreams. I always felt so refreshed when I got up from a murder. Well, he wasn't dying on me. So, you know, but intuitively, it's real funny how deep inside you know they will drink again. He always drank again. And sure enough, he was going to drink again. But you see, I got to thinking about this, and I read in the paper where a woman had killed her husband, and they put her away. I said, that is tacky, tacky, tacky. Because if I'd have been on that jury, she would have been walking the streets. I mean, to tell you, that's how it was. Because if you were living like I was living, you would understand that was grounds for murder, to have to live like that. And so then I began to think again, well, we can't use our plans now because we're going to have to do it a little. What would happen if a drunk were to pass out in the bathtub and drown? That'll do. That'll get it. I still think it'd work. Anyway, so that thing would stay in my mind, and I would think about that. Well, sure enough, J.D. got drunk again. A year to the week he went on Anabuse, J.D. got drunk. And there was ice and snow on the ground, so at first I didn't know he was drunk. He just sort of wiped out the hitching post torch at the end of the driveway, went shooting across the yard, hit the redbud tree, bounced into the side of the house. And I thought, he can't drive on this for nothing. But he opened the truck door and he poured out. Now, you've seen that too many times. You know the difference between an accident and drunk. Intuitively, you know that. And I looked out that front window, out my picture window, and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. So when he came through the door, I didn't say anything. I just hit him. And when I hit him, he fell. And he hit the coffee table and he knocked himself out. And so I drug him across the living room floor down the hall into the bathroom. I filled the bathtub full of warm water, took his clothes off of him, put him in, and I held him under till the bubbles quit coming. Because I hated his guts and I wanted him dead. And a voice came inside of me this time and it said, "Look what you're doing. You can't do this." So I picked him up by the hair of the head and I said, "The hell I can't." And I put him back down again. And so I'm looking at him. He's laying there in the bottom of the tub. And the voice came back and said, "You're committing murder, you know. You're taking the life of someone you once loved. You're committing murder." This was the first time the word murder had come in all those months. It wasn't murder. This was justified. Well, now it was murder. It was premeditated murder. And God, I got scared. So I jerked him out of that tub. And see, thank God I had worked for the Red Cross because I knew how to resuscitate him. And so I took him and resuscitated him and I put him in bed and I got the hair dryer down and dried his hair. See, I didn't want him to catch cold. I had a lot of trouble with step two. Well, things were different this time, for sure. You see, I shut the door on that room and I didn't go back in there for 3 days. I would go in, I would sit in my chair and I would rock for about 8 or 10 hours and then I'd get up the next morning and I'd go to work as if nothing had happened. Now, what was going on in that room? I don't know for sure because, you see, I didn't go in, but I heard sounds. I heard screams. I heard begging. I heard pleading. I heard him talking to things that weren't even there. I heard all this stuff. And when I went in that room 3 days later, there was blood everywhere, dried blood. You see, J.D. had nearly hemorrhaged to death in that room. He had drank too much in a short period of time. His body had lost the ability to pass out. You see, alcoholism is a progressive disease. And during that year, his body had lost the ability to do that. And he nearly died from the alcoholic poisoning, much less the drowning, you know. So when I came home, he was sitting at our bar, shaking real hard, trying to drink a cup of coffee. And he said, "You know, I must be an alcoholic. Will you call that Alcoholics Anonymous thing for me?" And I said, "Okay. But first I want to know, what can a group of drunks do for you that I haven't done?" And he said, "I don't know, but I'm going to die if I don't get some help." So I dialed Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said that there was a meeting in 1 hour's time, 6 blocks away from our home. And when they told me the location, I like to freaked out. You see, that building was built back in the 30s by my grandfather who died of alcoholism. And I went there to Girl Scout meetings when I was a kid. I couldn't believe that it was that close all along. And people there are being healed of the disease of alcoholism and Al-Anonism today. There's something very special about that for me. But anyway, I took him over there to his first meeting, and I went in with him just to make sure he'd get there. And I was dressed so that I would not overshadow you poor wretches. And they thought I was the alcoholic and he was the Al-Anon. I was in such good shape. And I explained to him very quickly that wasn't the case. And there were a couple of Al-Anon women came over and they said, "We have Al-Anon, it's for you." And I said, "There's nothing wrong with me." You see, I was still in deep denial. I knew there was something wrong with him, but there wasn't. Now, sitting in that chair rocking for all those hours, I knew I had lost my mind. But I didn't know. You know, it's like you know you've got to do something different, but you don't know what to do different. You don't know how to do different. And so you do what you've always done, and that is you justify and you rationalize, if he hadn't have done this, I wouldn't have had to do that. And that's how you can make it okay to do anything. And that's what I had done one more time. Well, J.D. began to get better. So if you've got someone that you'd like to see get into one of the fellowships, the best suggestion I have for you is shut up and leave them alone and just do your thing. You work your program. And if they're the misery that's going to cause them will be absolutely horrible. Because he wouldn't play my games with me anymore. You know, he'd come in and I'd say, "We need to talk." And he'd say, "Easy, does it." And I'd say, "J.D., what is this crap?" He'd say, "Honey, you got to learn to live and let live." Garbage, garbage, all this garbage he's feeding at me. So finally, something had to happen for me to hit bottom. Now, all these years that we're going through this madness, I know he doesn't love me. There's all these other women. I don't love him. I'm trying to kill him. The only thing that I have that means anything whatsoever to me are my material possessions. My things. Those are my big items, my things. And J.D. got sober, and J.D. got fired. Now, J.D. sometimes didn't work for 2 days a week. But then that year that he was not drinking, he had worked, and so we had really gotten adjusted to a big standard of living now with my working and his working, and I'd had several promotions. And all of a sudden now, I became the breadwinner. And I got scared I was going to lose my things. And that's what caused me to go to Al-Anon, because my life was unmanageable. I didn't know it, but my life was unmanageable. And I asked them, I said, how do you keep an alcoholic sober, and how do you manage when there's nothing left to manage? And there was a real smart aleck. She said, we don't know. But the two words that helped me more than anything at my first meeting were, we understand. And then they began to share with me some of the things that had happened to them. And I knew that they knew. It's like people are staring in your windows and you don't know it. It's like people are living in your skin and you didn't know it. Because they know, because they've been there too. Well, I would get me a sponsor, and I had a real hard time because, see, I'm a know-it-all. And when you know everything, it's real hard to learn anything. And she told me, she said, we're going to get rid of yes, but, what if, and I know. And I thought about that, and I said, okay. And then I'd be talking to her on the phone, and all of a sudden it'd be dead. I'd use one of the words, you know, because she didn't listen to yes, but, what if, and I know. And so, I mean, she just wouldn't answer me. It's just like I hadn't even said anything, and that would be real frustrating, and then I would realize I had said, but what if? Yes, but. And see, because every time I'd say what if, I was not dealing in reality, because if hadn't happened yet. Every time I said yes, but, I was saying, yes, but I'm not hearing you because this is what the deal is over here. And I know, when I tell you I know, you can't tell me nothing because I know. So there's that closed mind. So there was no point in trying to deal with someone, and I didn't realize. And I had to take them out of my vocabulary first before I could take them out of my mind and to go in to learn how to live without those things. Now, in Al-Anon, they taught me that you can't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. I learned in AA meeting that their three C's are different than ours. Theirs are con 'em, confuse 'em, and conquer. So I learned not to play their three C's either, you know, that fast talking for slow thinking where they got you before you know what's happened to you. You know one of those? So there were a lot of things that I had to learn. And it took a long time because I didn't get to where I was overnight. I wasn't going to get well overnight. But then, as time went on and as I worked the steps in my life, changes came. And it was like you didn't know the change had happened until much later. And then you'd look back and see that it had happened. You didn't know when it had happened. And I think if we could figure out how this deal really works, we'd screw it up. Because we'd try to change it to make it better and improve upon it. And you can't improve upon it. You just do it the way it is. Well, my sponsor told me, there was this little girl came up to me and she said, I want you to sponsor me. I'd been in the program 3 months. And I said, you've got to be out of your mind. And she said, probably. Well, this little girl, as my sponsor told me, she said, you tell her what I tell you, and you can't hurt her. But you see, I couldn't just leave that alone. And J.D. and I decided we'd be marriage counselors, and in 6 months, we had them divorced with our help, you know. But it was real funny because, you see, that little girl crossed over to the other side. She was in the wrong program. And I don't know why it is, but I find that in my group, I'm basically in charge of diagnosis and referrals. Where the alcoholics come to hide out in Al-Anon until we can get them directed where they need to go. And that's okay, too. I get real tickled about that because I have sponsored a lot of alcoholic women over the years. But anyway, there was such a thing, I couldn't have children. And so when these people would ask me to sponsor them, I began to feel some of those feelings, you know, those motherhood feelings that you never get to use or you never get to all that stuff. I began to feel like a mama. And that's okay to a certain point as long as you don't mother them. You know, you carry a message, not a person. And I got that confused for a long time. But I began to understand that another one of the miracles was the love. There's something that's so healing about the love and the laughter in these rooms. It carried, you know, they loved me till I could love me. And that's something that's real important to learn, to love yourself. Because I didn't know how to love anybody else until I could love me. But they could love me, and it made me feel good. That 1 hour that I could go to that meeting, or that hour and a half, whatever, I felt safe. I felt safe in those meetings. And, you know, we were talking one day about, you ever have a fantasy that wasn't fulfilled when you were a child? And I said, yes. Yes. I tell you, I went to a livestock show parade when I was about 8 years old. And there was a black high school that had a marching band with majorettes. And I'd never seen anything strut like those black girls did in them little short skirts with them high-top white boots with them tassels. I thought they were the grandest thing I ever saw, and I wanted a set of them boots. I knew I could walk like that if I had a pair of them boots. So every year for Christmas or my birthday or whatever, I'd ask Mama for my drum majorette boots and my baton and all that stuff, and I never got it. And I asked Mother about it one time, and she said, "You were such a tomboy, I knew you'd never keep it clean." And I thought, what a dumb reason for not getting the boots. What a dumb reason. But knowing my mother, she's very practical. So therefore, that would have made sense to her. And I could accept that then. But I said, I often wondered, because I knew we had the money, how come I never got the boots? Well, one year, I think it was when I was 40, I guess, at Christmas, the girls that I sponsor, a whole bunch of them went together, and they came over to my house before the meeting one night, and they brought me the boots, the hat, and the giant baton, and we marched to the meeting. You know, people love you a lot when they try to make your dreams come true. They love you a lot. And I can tell you, an 8-year-old kid never appreciated those boots like a 40-year-old woman did. There was just something inside of me that was one of the most wonderful things. They've done some things that were not so wonderful. They try to help you, you know. And I had a lot of fears when I came in this program. I didn't know it. I would tell you I was not a fearful person, and I was afraid of everything. And one of the fears that I had was I was afraid of heights. And every time I'd get caught, well, even this, I couldn't have done this deal, you know. You'd stand there and you'd feel like you're pitching forward. I couldn't handle it. I'd get sick at my stomach. I'd get cold chills. I just couldn't handle it. And so step 6 and 7 are the steps that changed my life, becoming willing to do something different and asking God to take those things away. Take away those things that keep me from enjoying the fullness of what God has here for me. And so they decided they'd help God along, and they got me a ticket for a hot air balloon ride. Because I told them I was praying about it, and I said, "Oh, thank you so much." Well, I want you to know I went on my hot air balloon ride, and it was wonderful. It was just wonderful. There's no sensation of flight whatsoever. It's not like being in a plane. You're just floating along in the air until you get to the landing, and it's a crash landing at best. And the only thing that happened there was that they sort of got away from us, and the pilot said in 15 years he hadn't had as many things go wrong. Like, for instance, right off the get-go, we left the two-way radio on the ground where you had no communication with the chase car. This was starters. And we're going along, and then when you get to the point where you come down for a landing, they have a big thing they click on. It's like parachute strap, and they throw it down, and they sort of guide you in. Well, we didn't clip ours on. We just threw it over. So there was no way to stop. And so then after we crossed the freeway and we just keep going, and he said, "Well, we got about 10 minutes fuel left." And I went, "Oh, this is not a good sign, is it?" He said, "Well, we'll do like they did in the olden days. We'll just sort of drag on a tree." Drag on a tree. He said, "Yeah." And about that time, all of a sudden, here comes the tree. And so now we're hung in the top of a big oak tree. And we're breaking off branches, and he's giving it more gas to get us out of the oak tree, because we're literally jammed in the top. And then's when I realized the fear of heights was gone. Ground is what you fear. High is good. Low is bad. It's just a matter of perspective, that's all. And we got out, and then we finally came down, and we crashed into this thoroughbred horse farm out there in the field. And they had just mowed the hay, so it was just really a nice soft crash landing. And when we got out, the guy looks at me, the pilot, and he says, "I don't suppose that you ever want to fly again." I said, "Yes, it was wonderful." He said it was my adrenaline fix. But the amazing thing about it was his uncle had come with him that day to help him to get the balloon ready. And his uncle had never flown, so we said, "Why don't you come in and go with us?" His uncle, he said, he heard my husband calling me Murph, and he said, Murph, he said, "Are you the Murph?" And I said, "Well, I'm the only Murph I know." And he said, "I've just joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had heard a tape of a lady." He said, "Would that be?" And I said, "Yes, and you're here for a happening." I said, "You're going to get to see God remove the fear of heights from me today. Aren't you the lucky one?" But isn't that neat? Isn't that neat, you know, that God would put somebody else there too? But it did happen, and I'm not afraid of the heights anymore. You see, I don't have to go and crawl into the Grand Canyon on my belly, look over and go, "Oh, it's nice, it's nice," and then back up. And that's what I did the first time I went there. because I was so afraid. Now, there's been a lot of healing in my relationship with J.D. J.D. is not the man I would have molded him into, thank God. He is far, far greater than that. We have a wonderful marriage. We have been married, this year will be 22 years. 22 years. That is a miracle. Thursday night, we were out eating at a restaurant, and the minister who married us was sitting at the table next to us. And I said, would you have thought it would have lasted? He said, not a bit. Not a bit. And we wouldn't have either. We wouldn't have given you a dime. Even 2 or 3 years into the program, we would not have given you a dime for our chances of being together. We have been married over twice as long in sobriety as we were during the drinking. And the hardest things have happened in sobriety. The hardest things. The hardest things to go through. Well, I want to tell you about one last thing. I want to tell you about my relationship with my mother, because you see, that was probably more screwed up than the relationship I had with J.D. Because I had hated her all my life, and I knew my mother didn't love me. And there's something that happens inside of a kid. You know, you want approval from your mother, and you want love from your mother, and those are the things that I felt like I never got from my mama. And so I had tried to make an amends to her, and it would never go right. Every time I'd go over there trying to make that amends, it just wouldn't do right. I would get into a fight. Every time I'd go try to make the amends, we'd get into a fight. And I realized later that what I was trying to do, I was trying to make the amends because I was told to make the amends, not because I really felt that I owed her an amends. I felt like she owed me the amends because she had hurt me so. Well, God, when the teacher becomes ready, I mean the student becomes ready, a teacher appears. And so a girl came from another group in another state who had worked on mother problems. And she said, Mary Pearl, you don't accept your own limitations, therefore you don't accept your mother's. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, you don't accept the fact that you are the way you are towards your mother any more than you accept the way she is towards you. She said, you don't be kind and loving to her because she won't be to you. She said, you know, the program has to start with you. She doesn't have a program. You have to do your thing. Well, I said, that's not fair. She says, that's right, it's not. You know, and I saw a little thing the other day about fair. It says, just because you're a warm and wonderful person doesn't mean that the bull's not going to charge you just because you're a vegetarian. You know, life is not fair. Life is not fair. But anyway, so as time went on, she said, you have to accept that. So, all right, I accepted that, and I said, all right, God, you're going to be my mother too. I can't get what I need from mother. Because every time I'd find myself, every time I would go to a dry hole. I'd go over there expecting her to be different. Expecting her not to react like she's always done. And it didn't work. So I was going to have to be the one to be different. So then she said, why don't you ask God to let you see your mother like He sees her? Now this is one of the greatest tools I've ever been given. Because it works with anybody you're having a problem with. Is to pray and ask God to let you see that person as He sees them. And when I went over to see my mother that day, my mother was raking leaves. And my mother is always a very formidable woman. My mother was like 5'2". I looked at her and said, she's short. Because every time I would go over there, I went as a little kid. When you're a little kid, you're little and they're big. So therefore, she always appeared big to me. So her glasses were real thick, so her eyes looked big and buggy and made her look harsh. And I said, she's just a little person. And I'd look at her and it was like you could look right through her, to her heart. And I saw scars on her heart. I saw bitterness. I saw a lot of hurt. I saw a lot of fear. I saw someone who needed love, not someone who had love to give. You know, we learn in here, you cannot transmit that you do not have. And all of a sudden, I saw my mother didn't have. So I went over to my mother, and I put my arms around my mother, and she stiffened up, because that's not something that we would do. But I needed to do that for me. I needed to take those steps for me. And then as time went on, I realized what a disservice I had done her by comparing her to my daddy, whom I made a saint. And I had made, and when you're compared to a saint, you're always going to come up on the short end of the stick. And I didn't know how to tell her that. I didn't know how to communicate those things to her. And you know, it's having that knowledge up here doesn't necessarily mean it does anything down here. If there's a process. And one day, I had been to the bank, and the thought came to me, go by and see your mother today. So I went directly from the bank to my mother's. And my mother wanted to talk to me about some things that happened when Daddy died. And when we got to discussing it, she said, what do you remember? And I told her what I remembered. And she said, well, I don't remember it that way. And I thought, oh, here we go. And instead, she said, you know, you were 12 years old. I was almost 60. We would have looked at it a lot differently. A lot differently. And I thought, boy, that was profound from her. You see, I never gave her credit for having any sense. And then she said, you know, I never understood why you were such a rotten, ornery kid. And I said, because I was getting even with you. Because you didn't love me. And she said, I didn't love you. And I said, no. I said, Mama, you never held me. You never said you did good. You always criticized me. You never hugged me. You never did any of those things. She said, my God, I gave you a roof over your head, food to eat, clothes to wear. It was more than I ever had. And you see, my mother had come from that alcoholic home where her mother and father both drank. She was physically and emotionally abused in that home. Her father tried to rape her when she was 13 years old, and she left home. Now think about it. This is the early 1900s, and she's a child of the streets. And she went from Gleason, Tennessee to Memphis by herself, eating out of garbage cans, robbing gardens and what have you, and walking. Where she lived, she never went back home again. She had not been taught how to love. So to her, the greatest thing that she could have had would have been the roof over her head, clothes to wear, and food to eat. She gave the best that she could possibly think of giving. And I knew it that day. And I also knew that day what a disservice I had done her by expecting her to be like I wanted her to be. I wanted her to be nurturing and kind and someone I could talk to, someone I could listen to. That wasn't where her gifts were. And so I knew I owed her an amends. And so I said, Mama, how could you forgive me for all the things? What can I do for you to forgive me for the things that I've done, so many of them on purpose to hurt you? And she said, forgive me for not being the kind of mama you needed. And so I held my mama that day, and my mother put her arms around me, and she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And you see, she had, to the very best of what she knew as love. She had loved me the best. And our relationship began to heal that day. And we had a very good 4 or 5 years. A very good. And then my mother got a mental sickness. And part of that sickness was the first person she turns against is the one she's the closest to. And so she began to turn against me and my husband. And she loved him like a son. And she began to accuse us of stealing things from her and doing things to her. And, you know, we would detach. And it was sort of like dealing with alcoholism. Dealing with someone whose mind is being altered and trying not to take it to heart. And you can do that for a time, and then sometimes you can't do that. And so we would have our ups and downs over the next several years. And then last year, my mother's disease was progressive, just like alcoholism. And she had gotten to the point where she physically attacked me, and she had tried to have me arrested. And so I knew that it was impossible then. I was going to have to sever that relationship with my mother. And it was very devastating. It was right before Easter of last year. And so I got really upset around Mother's Day because it seemed so strange not having a mother but yet having a mother. No one to send a card to, no one to share the day with. And I was sitting there and I was feeling very sorry for myself, extremely sorry for myself. And one of the girls that I sponsor in Mississippi called me and she said, I want to thank you for being my mama, because she said, you've nurtured me and loved me and you've done those things like a mother. And I sat there and I said, God, where's my mama been all these years? Where was my mama for me? And it was like my life passed in front of my face in a very short period of time. And I realized that my sister, the one that's 15 years older than me, had never had any children, she had been there for me. She had done all those nurturing things that a mother does. I can remember the first thing that I remembered was when I was 5 or 6 years old, she bought me a subscription to Donald Duck comic book. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but I can tell you what, getting a piece of mail when you're 6 years old is a big deal. And I felt special. That's the point. I felt special. All my life, Dorothy did things for me to make me feel special. My mother was a dressmaker. I hated homemade clothes. Even though my mother did, people came from far and wide for my mama to sew, I wanted a store-bought dress. So for my senior prom formal, my sister let me go down and order one from New York, an original. Broke my mother's heart. Found out later. But you see, I got that dress that I wanted because that was something special for me. And Dorothy had been there. And during the height of my crazies, when I was doing all these things that I had not been raised to do, when I was going against every value system I had, people would say to my sister, what's the matter with Mary Pearl? And she would say, I don't know. I don't like what she's doing, but I love her. And my sister never turned me away. My sister had been my mother all my life. And I got my sister a card, and I got her some flowers, and I thanked her for being my mother. And my sister looked at me, and she held me, and she said, "You've always been my kid to me." And J.D. was witnessing this, and he said, "I want some of that, too." And he came over, and we all three hugged and kissed, and you see our family, which had been torn apart by mother's sickness, healed back together again. My mother had a stroke in June. I had some health problems of my own, which were life-threatening last year. And my mother's stroke, it completely wiped out her communication system. She couldn't read, she couldn't write, she couldn't talk. And it was very pathetic. But she could feel, and she could, in her head, she would try so hard to communicate with you. And all my mother could say was, "We will." And she'd go, "We will, we will, we will, we will, we will, we will, we will." And she'd look at you like, "Why don't you respond back?" And so finally one day I sat down and I said, "Mama, listen. We will, we will, we will, we will." And she looked at me and I said, "That's what I hear too. It's hard, ain't it?" And she nodded. We had to put her in a nursing home. That was one of her greatest fears, was having to go to a nursing home. And God prepared the way. And we found a wonderful nursing home. You know, you think of it in terms of horrible, horrible. This place was wonderful. Wouldn't mind going there myself. And they treat you with a lot of love there. And we had to put her there. She was not happy there. But I would go and see her. And did you know, my mother would hold me, and she'd let me hug her, and she'd touch my face. And we were able to communicate. And finally one day, she was trying to communicate with me so hard. And I finally figured out, and she was asking me to forgive her one more time. And I was able to hold her and love her and say, "Mama, I love you and I forgive you. And don't worry about that." I would take her out of the nursing home and we'd go get her hair done and we'd get her a manicure. She'd never had a manicure in all her life. Painted women had manicures. My mama became a painted woman. And she went back to the home and she ran into every room and went, she was so proud of her little painted nails. Those are some wonderful memories that I have that I would have been denied had I not had a program to follow and people like you to be there and walk with me through this. I did not have to do this deal alone. In October, my mother had another massive stroke in which she became a vegetable. That was very difficult to watch the disease progress. And the only way that she could communicate was through tears. And then on the 1st of January, mother had pneumonia. And then she recovered from that. And you know, it's real funny. Last summer, out in my backyard, we have an annual yard party every year at our house. We started talking about our group. We have a very large group. We have 111 home group members. And we talked about, why don't we have a conference? And we said, why not? You know, I mean, you have ideas. Why not? So we had our first conference, the 1st of February of this year. And while I was away, we went out. We didn't just have it downtown. We went out so we'd be by ourselves. And we went to this beautiful, beautiful place on the lake and took the whole place. And my sister called me and she said, "It's over. Mother has passed away tonight. She had another stroke." And I can't tell you the feelings that I had at that moment. It was sort of like you're numb. But there was a part of me that was relieved that it was over for her because she'd been such a vegetable and that was not any quality of life whatsoever she'd had for so long. And I had thought of all those times when she couldn't speak at all after that second stroke, how I would have given anything to hear the "wee woe, wee woe." And I turned around and you see, J.D. was there with me and I told him that Mother had died and he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I don't know. I just want to be, I think, for a while." And all of a sudden, you know how news travels. Within 5 minutes, I think everybody there knew. And I was carried on a blanket of love that weekend by the people there. You see, God knew when I was out in the backyard where I was going to need to be for Him to carry me during that crisis. And the day of the funeral was very much like today, cold and rainy and drizzly. I want you to know the rain stopped 10 minutes before the service. And it started 10 minutes after the service. And who were the people there? They were our people. Got out in that miserable kind of weather. All those people that came and stood by that old cold graveside. And they were there for me. And I love them. You know, the only thing, my sister turned to me and she said, "I hope they don't see keep coming back at the end of the prayer." I said, "They may. We have been known to do that. We've been known to do that." But you know, I'm glad that I had that time. And we've been going through my mother's things now. And I want to tell you about something about this woman that didn't love me. I want to tell you about the woman that didn't love me. She loved material things. She was always fearful. I found a receipt in her strong box. In 1950, my mother bought me a bicycle from Sears Roebuck and bought it on a contract. It cost $68.37. For my mother to spend that kind of money was a big sacrifice. She did it for me. I never knew that she cared that much. You see, that was her way. And so I have saved that. That's one of the most... I found my baby curls, my baby clothes. Mama never threw anything away on something. But that meant more to me because that was my favorite thing when I was growing up, was my bicycle. And my mother bought it because there's a contract agreement signed in her name. And she paid it out by the month so I could have it for Christmas that year. That's love from my mother. And it was sort of like she was telling me from the grave, I still love you and you're still special. That's what God and the program of Al-Anon and people like you did for me and my mother. I have good memories of my mother today. Good memories of my mother. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but He worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget He sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But those dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver and the pattern God has planned. Thank you.